with Gloucester Fire Chief Eric Smith now. And Chief, a big fire over the weekend, a very dangerous fire over the weekend, bad enough for the families on the one hand, but on the other hand, it was well taken care of by the firefighters on scene. So maybe a little recap on what happened.
Sure. This past Saturday, we received a call for a working fire at 76 Centennial Ave that was quickly extending to the neighboring structure at 74 Centennial. They were actually the caller. They're the ones that identified the fire. The homeowners at 76 were out at the time. And so the initial alarm and notification to us came in shortly after 5 o'clock. I believe it was 1703, in our dispatch time. So that that call goes through, I believe it was cell phone that made the call, talking to the folks at 74. So that technically goes up to the Middleton dispatch. They cover all Essex County, part of Middlesex, about 130-something communities for any cell phone calls to 911. That goes through state 911, and they in turn notify our local dispatch center, which is our police department, and they in turn tell us. So it's kind of a little bit of a delay, but that's just part of the way the cell phone technology has been managed and interfaced into 911. So it went quickly. I mean, they don't spend a lot of time on the phone, obviously. They get us that information as quick as possible, and on arrival, obviously, as we were told by the caller, that not only was the initial home involved, it was quickly spreading and starting to do damage to his home.
I have a follow-up, obviously, but the question of 911, I just realized that locally, if we know the local fire station number here in Gloucester or in any community, is it actually quicker to call the station, or do you get into that recorded mess?
Yeah, the problem with dialing direct to any of our lines is that you're subject to less accountability, if you will, really less staffing in some regards, because we specifically here in the station, we only have one dispatcher, and so the intent of that position within our framework and our setup is that dispatcher is going to take information from our primary PSAP, which is the police department, and they handle all the 911 calls and all the callers directly. If it was an EMS call, they manage emergency medical dispatch to help give you CPR instructions, bleeding control. If you're in your home, to evacuate and go to a safe meeting point and those types of things. And they have more people on duty to manage that because they realize they're going to interface with the public. They have that responsibility and that role. Same with the 911 calls that actually go to the dispatch center in Middleton. And so they do the same thing. So they've got a larger staff to handle that. We don't. And frankly, if we were to receive those calls directly, especially in an event like this where there's a large column of smoke, many people witnessing it, they don't know if a call's been made yet or not, and so you get a lot of the Good Samaritans stepping up to make sure that there's been a notification, and so it really can bog down the phone lines, and it'll overwhelm our dispatcher. His prime objective and responsibility down there is really not to interface with the public, but to interface with another professional dispatcher who feeds him the pertinent information that he needs to get the right equipment at the right time in the right place.
So for the public, it's 911.
911 all day long. Okay. At some point or another, the old 2424 line that does still ring through here is predominantly used by fire alarm services and medical alert services. Will likely move over to the police department so they can take all those calls in and properly process them as we kind of evolve in dispatch. Ideally, we would gravitate to a regional dispatch system, whether that be done here in Gloucester with just the CAPAN communities or something a little bit larger. But it's certainly, especially these kind of events, you need a larger staff to handle that quick, high volume of calls and to be able to take that information in, properly process it, and not have the call takers, at the same time trying to be the ones to dispatch and coordinate those resources that are responding. So that's why we don't want the calls here, because our guy's too busy talking to our own internal communications with our fire apparatus and our officers regarding where they're going, what they need, and when they arrive, as they did that day. We went from, you know, just a single call and a call that was a very strong indication of a working fire. We knew that going out the door, that we were likely, you know, going to roll up on a working fire. Obviously, when they got there, the extent of that fire drove them quickly from a working fire, a first alarm assignment, up to four alarms within about the first 10 minutes. So it, you know, that's a lot of work for one person sitting in our dispatch center to muster all of that equipment there and make all the right contacts to our neighboring communities to get them to respond, our regional dispatch point that's going to go out beyond a third alarm. So we hand that off to a control point in Beverly, and they start making those phone calls to the Salems and the Wenhams once we hit a third alarm to kind of relieve our dispatcher from making all those individual phone and radio calls.
Who made the call on Saturday? And as you said, that happened very quickly, and to get it from 1 to 4.
Yeah, so that would be Deputy Chief Andy McRobb. He was the incident commander. He's the shift commander on Group 1 that was on duty. And again, those guys did an outstanding job. I said that at the time during the fire, during interviews and subsequent. But if it wasn't for the actions that they take immediately and the additional equipment that was called for immediately, that fire could have turned out much different. You know, the conditions of the day really were ideal, with it being a moderate temperatures, almost no wind, daylight, you know, gives us an advantage to dealing with that, because it's, you know, we can see it and manage it and handle it a little bit better, get a quicker assessment on it than in different conditions. I mean, if the wind is blowing, we're looking at, you know, a lot faster flame spread than what we had. It was moving quick enough. By the time they pulled up, they had two houses going. So they were able to hit that quickly with master streams and start to get that thing under control and at least contain the fire to those two homes. The third home that has been reported to have damage, it was really more smoke and water damage than anything. There wasn't an extreme amount of heat. There may be some minor heat damage, but that home didn't actually catch fire. But, you know, smoke in and of itself is obviously toxic. And so the building inspector and I agreed that, you know, those folks shouldn't be in that home that night until a proper assessment could be made. Evaluate their smoke detectors to make sure that they weren't fouled out by any smoke that got into their house and there would be, you know, somewhat inoperable or not completely accurate in their detection. And with the structure being compromised at 76 and that house having to be raised, having anybody home in either house, even if those houses were intact, is not a good idea when you have heavy machinery taking down an unstable structure. So they would have been, you know, put out of the house for that reason alone.
Chief, you also found out fairly quickly that the houses were evacuated or unoccupied. How did that? How did you manage that?
Yeah, those from the reports that I'm getting, and I'm still kind of playing catch up on a big scene like that with the deputies and some of the firsthand information that kind of falls through the cracks, if you will, of you know, initial folks in the neighborhood doing their part. So the call originated from the neighbor at 74 while he was out doing yard work, and that quickly moved through the neighborhood by obviously people noticing the smoke. We actually had an off-duty firefighter, Jack Brancaleone, who was down the street. I believe there was a graduation party or something going on, birthday party. Again, I don't have all the details, but he ran over and assisted the neighbor in making sure evacuations of the surrounding homes and the involved home were taken care of. So, you know, it was certainly a community effort and a significant effort by anybody that was in the neighborhood to clear out of the way so we could do our job to get us notified as quickly as possible. And the most important thing is to make sure that our friends, family, and neighbors were out of harm's way while our guys are responding and then doing their job.
Did you talk to any of the homeowners on a job like that? Is it a part of the work?
Absolutely, and part of what I do when I get to these scenes, a scene like that is a significant fire, but it's not outside the abilities of the deputies to manage. They've got plenty of resources coming in to provide them the personnel that they need. Typically, somewhere around the third or fourth alarm, which obviously we struck through those pretty quickly, is somewhere where I would probably jump in and take command. that way it relieves the deputy of having to deal with other resource issues such as staging and the media and so forth. But at the point that I arrived, things were already well contained, and they were really in kind of the mop-up phase, if you will, of getting this thing done. So I left the deputy in command. He was doing a great job and had a good handle on all his assets and resources. So from that point on, I do basically what I do at most of them is try to make sure that A, where are the families? Have we pulled in all the resources we need to take care of them? They're the priority, you know, both life safety at in the initial phase of the fire to make sure no one's in the houses. If they were to get them out and get them the care they need, but now they're displaced from their home. Now they need a place to stay. They might need medications, their, you know, charger for a cell phone, something that simple, the keys for the car that were still inside. So those are the things that I try to jump in that are kind of those small details that make a big difference in our residents' lives that really are something not really, you know, the deputy doesn't really have time to do that right. While he's trying to manage, you know, four alarms worth of resources. So that's something that I typically jump in and try to do, get names, phone numbers, get Red Cross on the way out like we did that day, and, you know, just start trying to get those people in a better place and get them focused on what the next steps are that they need to take in their life to try to get, you know, their whole home situation back in order, which obviously when one of the homes has to be razed is a life-changing event. You know, that's a difficult thing to manage and deal with. So we bring in a Red Cross so they at least have a place to stay local. You know, usually almost everybody in town here has friends and family close by. But it's a lot to ask to suddenly drop in on relatives and friends and have to stay the night, and you have only the clothes on your back, literally. It makes it tough on everybody. So, you know, those friends and family are a great support system. And if they can do more for you if they're not trying to actually physically take care of your housing needs themselves. Some people can manage it. They've got the house for it, and others can't. So bringing in the Red Cross does that, gives them at least a few-day buffer before the insurance companies kind of ramp up and start doing the things they do to help settle that claim and work to get them back in order, get some clothes on their back, get their medications replaced, cell phone chargers, you know, all the things that you don't think about until you have that horrible day. And, you know, it can be pretty overwhelming. So I try to bridge that gap between what the family can do. You know, unfortunately, this is what we do for a living, so to speak. And we're there on people's worst day of their life. So we try to ease that as best we can and give them some insight as to what works well, how to kind of go about taking those next steps, you know. So that's, you know, pretty much where I jump in when I have the luxury of not having to take command, which thankfully the deputies here do a great job. And there hasn't been one incident that I've had to step in and say, okay, I'm going to be the incident commander and you just run the operation. They're very competent in what they do.
And finally, Chief, in that regard, how many guys work the fire? And you give me an idea of the amount of equipment and stuff that was used.
Yeah, so for this particular run, by the time we got up to four alarms, you're looking at us having every piece of equipment that was in service for all four stations at that incident, as well as additionally our ladder two was put in service and brought to the scene. We also had an engine from Rockport, Essex, at the scene immediately. The ladder truck from Ipswich was here, you know, fairly quickly. It's obviously a bit of a drive for everybody. We all know where these stations are at. So we also recall our own personnel when we hit a second alarm. So we had about a little over a dozen of our own folks that were back in town and helped staff up our reserve trucks, not only to respond to the incident, but also to cover the rest of the city, because operations for the rest of the city, both for fire and EMS responses, they don't stop just because we have one major incident going. So we still have to maintain that responsibility. And not only do we try to do that internally, obviously our neighbors come in to help us. So we had, you know, Wenham, Hamilton, Beverly, Danvers, as well as Salem, all had apparatus in town. So they were either at the scene with us working that fire, or they were in our stations covering to help make sure the rest of the city's safe and protected.
Okay, finally, any undisclosed injuries the next day?
No, I mean, just the usual bumps and bruises, a couple of reports, you know, guys that, you know, wind shifts and they take in a couple lungful of smoke. Obviously, we know how lethal and deadly the chemicals are in smoke, and it's not something that's an immediate injury typically if you're outside the building. But over the course of a, you know, 30-plus year career, unfortunately, that's why cancer presumption and the heart-lung bill are in place, because it's, you know, scientifically and medically proven that firefighters are apt to get cancer at a much higher rate than most folks in the public, and it's typically not an acute onset. It's over a lifetime of doing this work and exposure to these toxins and carcinogens, and so that's something that we document to make sure that, yeah, it's in their file, and at some point, if they, while still on the job, come down with cancer, that we're doing the right thing for our guys and making sure that they're covered and taking care of them and their families, because now, unfortunately, it turns into their worst day when that occurs, and it's, you know, there's significant medical documentation that point right back at the job as being part of that. So we all know that going into it. You know, there's been a real push here, you know, in the fire service for the last 10 years regarding cancer presumption, and really Boston has been probably one of the leaders in this over the last 2-3 years. They got a new chief there who's doing a great job, and we've kind of rolled that right into our policies and procedures of how we clean ourselves up after an incident, how we better protect ourselves during the incident, you know, with respiratory protection and hoods, making sure we're washing our gear that kind of absorbs and hangs onto a lot of those toxins and carcinogens, changing out your uniforms and so forth. So there's a lot that goes in from our side to health and wellness and prevention of cancer in the fire service. So it's still something that's evolving, and we hope that better methods and gear continue to come out from, you know, better science. But there's still no way to mitigate that risk completely.
That's Gloucester Fire Chief Eric Smith.